If you haven't turned to Ephesians chapter 4, I'd like you to do that because I'd like you to follow along. This is one of those lessons where my main points will come directly from the text, and I hope that it will be something you'll be able to look back on and say, all right, I kind of remember what Bob said about it. I know most of you don't remember, probably 75, I'm hoping 75%, you know. Anyway, but, you know, if you get something out of my lesson, I'm happy with that. You know, if you go away with a general impression and a little bit of encouragement, I'm okay with that. I kind of, you know, get a little silly about how what I think everybody's going to remember, but that's all right. You know, I know people aren't going to remember everything I say. I hope, though, that as you think about this lesson, as you think about what the Apostle Paul says here in Ephesians 4, I want you to stop for just a few moments today and think about how short life is. Janet and I went to a funeral or a wake on Friday night for a friend of ours that we've known socially for some time. And we always really liked this individual. He was only 58. That's young by today's standards. He died of colon cancer. He'd been struggling with it for about 2 years. We didn't know because we hadn't seen him for a while. But he kind of waited to do some things until he got a little older. And by the time he did a couple of things, it was, you know, it just kind of happened too late. So it kind of made us think, and Janet and I were talking earlier in the week about how it just does make you think about focusing on what's really important, okay? And, you know, why not spend your time on the things that are really important? Even if you don't know, well, actually, you don't know how much time you have. That's the point. You know, people talk about their bucket lists, all the things they want to do before they die, you know? In 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 10 and 11, Paul gives Timothy a kind of bucket list, and I want you to think about what are really good bucket list things. In verse 10, Paul says, "For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs." But look at what Paul says here. "But as for you, O man of God, flee these things. Pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, steadfastness, and gentleness." That's a pretty interesting bucket list, isn't it? Things that you ought to be doing, you know, before you pass away, before you go into the next life. Would you think that your relationship with God and others was important enough to make those things your bucket list items? Paul kind of does that here. At least I want you to look at what he does here in Ephesians 4 with some of those things. He describes what I think that list ought to look like. You know, in a real way, bucket lists they're kind of selfish. They're things that I want to do before I die. And they're okay. I mean, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have those things we'd really like to do, but what are the things that are really important? Our relationship with God is very important. Our relationship with other people is really important. And as we look at this section, I want you to see one of the threads that runs through all of what we got here in Ephesians 4:25 through Ephesians 5:2 are all things that have to do with relating to one another. Paul will even use that phrase several times in here about one another or each other and about the kind of ways we're supposed to relate to one another. See if these things aren't the kind of things that we ought to focus on. First of all, in verse 25, Paul actually uses the phrase, "We are members of one another." Okay? And he mentions two things here that I think are two of the biggest relationship killers that I think we can think of. Number one is lying to each other. Paul says, "Having put away falsehood, let each of you speak the truth with his neighbor, for we are members of one another." Now, Paul is, obviously, this whole context here is church relationships, but I want you to see the relationships here as a paradigm for outside the church. You know, these aren't things he says, okay, it's okay to do here, but when you get outside, you can do whatever you want. I think we all know that, you know. But it's good to remember, this is a paradigm. This is the way we relate to one another here. It's the way we're supposed to relate to one another outside as well. Put away falsehood, speak the truth to each other. In Leviticus 19:11, there is a very strong prohibition, just do not lie to each other. That's the way the old law says it. And Paul has kind of brought this point up earlier in chapter 4 in verse 15. He says, rather speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up into every way into him who is the head, that is Christ. So he's already mentioned that truth-telling is very important, talking, saying the truth to one another. And think about what lies do, how they poison communication and they breed suspicion instead of mutual trust. Okay. Don't you want to have a mutual trust with other people rather than having a suspicious relationship? You know, what's that person up to? Why did they say what they said? Can I really trust them? You think about what that does to our relationships. Paul has already said here also in verse 22 that deceitful desires are at the very heart of a sinful nature. Deceit. Lies. Think about what that does to other people. And the relationship you have with other people. We are not to be people with hidden and deceitful agendas. We're supposed to be people who are just honest. So number one, a lie is one of the things that will kill our relationships. Number two is anger will kill a relationship quicker than a lot of other things. And a lot of us, I know for me, for the longest time, because I will have to admit that anger is one of those things that I have struggled with, and still do from time to time. He says here, be angry and do not sin. Paul is not giving us permission here. Okay, so let's kind of clear the air on that one here. When he says be angry and do not sin, he's not saying, well, it's okay to be angry. That's not really what he's saying. And the reason I say that is because of what he says further on down here. He says, get rid of anger and wrath. We'll come to that in a few minutes. But you see, I think what's being implied here, Paul is actually borrowing a phrase from the Old Testament. He's borrowing a phrase from one of the Psalms. Here's how one commentator put it, and I think this is accurate. Anger is to be avoided at all costs. But if, for whatever reason, you do get angry, then refuse to indulge such anger so that you do not sin. You know, we have to recognize we are often prone to being angry about something. We're prone to be angry about injustices. We're prone to be angry about somebody who has slighted us. We're prone to be angry, fill in the blank. You know, you can fill in the blank for what maybe we might get angry about. I used to think about 90 to 95% of our anger was not righteous indignation. I'm more inclined to think it's more like 99% is not righteous indignation, which we tend to justify, okay? So he's not really giving us permission to be angry. He's saying, guys, you need to get this under control. Anger is destructive. That's why James in James chapter 1 verse 19 kind of gives us the same caution where he says, be slow to anger because the anger of man does not bring about the righteous life that God desires. And Proverbs has many prohibitions on anger. Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and verse 9 says, be not quick to anger, for anger lodges in the bosom of fools. And if that doesn't kind of wake you up to how difficult or at least how destructive anger can be, it should. It should. Anger can cause estrangement from one another. That's why Paul will say here, get rid of it quickly. Don't let the sun go down while you're angry, because it festers, doesn't it? Anger just kind of festers, and it bubbles up, and it comes out at the wrong time, and it comes out in other ways, comes kind of out sideways in things that you don't want it to do. So because we are members of one another, Paul is saying, don't lie to each other and put away anger. Those things will help cement your relationships by not doing them. But then he goes on to say in verse 28, he says, have something to share with others. Now, he says it in kind of a unique context here because he's addressing something very specific. He's addressing those in the audience of the Ephesians who had stolen things before. And basically, he says, stop stealing. You know, let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor doing honest work with his own hands so that he may have something to share with anyone in need. Now, I'm kind of looking at this from the back end here. I'm looking at this from the standpoint of having something to share with somebody. I'm trying to give a little bit more positive spin on this prohibition against stealing, which is basically the eighth commandment. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 15, and it's repeated again in the book of Leviticus, chapter 19, verse 11, same passage where it prohibits lying. And yet, you see, Paul's exhortation here kind of goes a little deeper, doesn't it? He gets to a different kind of motivation. He's not just saying don't steal. He's saying think about having something to share with somebody else. So Paul's kind of taking us deeper into our souls here, isn't he? Rather than just, you know, this surface, oh, don't do this. Have a whole different attitude about doing that. Stealing are things that are taking things that belong to somebody else, that's being irresponsible with your own behavior. He's speaking to thieves in particular, but he says basically they need to become productive members of society. How much more, perhaps, for those of us who maybe we haven't stolen anything in our lives, but how much more ought we also to become productive members of society, of our communities, of having something that we can share with other people? Verse 28. Maybe we could just simply say it this way. Do honest work. Responsible members of the community don't become dependent on everybody else. This isn't the Christian way. And I'm very well aware that we sometimes fall on hard times. And sometimes maybe we need the help of other people. But it's a matter of, as Christians, do we stay in that situation? Wow. Do we keep ourselves there because it's easy, rather than becoming productive members of society? You know, the Bible has some very interesting things to say about giving, about changing the way we think about things. Giving is an unselfish, spiritually rewarding act. Acts chapter 20, verse 35, you've all heard it before. It is more blessed to give than to receive. That's probably something we have to learn, isn't it? It's an acquired taste. You know, some of you don't drink coffee because you don't like the taste. When I first started drinking it, I had to put a lot of cream and sugar in it. Now I can drink it black. But it's kind of an acquired taste. I think learning to give and like giving is an acquired taste. We learn by experience, perhaps, that it really is a joy to be able to give something. God gave his Son to demonstrate his love for us. 1 John chapter 4, 9 through 10. That's how we know what love is. God gave his Son. In Mark chapter 10, verse 45, Jesus says it another way. The Son of Man came to give his life as a ransom for many. He gave. You know, God didn't have to do what he did. Jesus didn't have to do what he did. He didn't owe us anything. He did it because God's nature is to be a giving, loving person. Being. Not just person, but you understand what I'm saying. And so, to us, part of our bucket list, is it not to experience the joy of giving rather than taking? I can't give you that experience. It's only an experience you can learn by doing it yourself. But it seems to me that's one of those things that, you know, maybe I should spend my time doing that rather than taking. And third, the final thing that I think he says here simply is demonstrating kindness and forgiveness toward one another. Now, he has a very interesting couple of lists here that are contrasted with that. In verse 31, I want you to look at this list very carefully. I'm going to go over it a little bit, but I want you to just think about what it looks like in practice, okay? He says here, let all bitterness, etc., say, basically saying get rid of all these things, okay? And he's not saying it with the same words, but I think up in verse 22 of the same passage, he has said that we are to remove or put off the old self and put on the new. All right, here are some specifics. Here are the things we ought to get rid of. All right, put off. Just listen to the list and I'll go through it. But again, I want you to think about it. What does it look like in practice? Number one is bitterness. Then he has wrath and anger. Then he has clamor. Then he has slander. And then he, just in case he missed anything, he says all malice. Bitterness. That which harbors resentment. Bitter people persistently let past hurts just kind of simmer. You know, you just let it get in there, you just let it boil, it simmers for a long time, and then all of a sudden it boils up and overflows and maybe even explodes. The next two things, the Stoic philosophers of Greece, or of the early centuries, put wrath and anger as kind of two separate things. They kind of go together, but they're a little different. They said wrath was kind of an explosion of hostility, and anger was a settled feeling of gnawing hostility. Okay? Think about what that produces between people. And then my translation uses the word clamor. Basically, it's shouting. I remember I had a guy that many years ago when I was, I was coaching Jonathan's T-ball team. And this guy worked on Wall Street. And he came one night, he made the comment to me about how calm I was being with the kids. And I thought, well, didn't think I was being that calm. Maybe it was inside I was turmoil, but outside I was going, I wanted to go, guys. But he said, you know, my environment on Wall Street is we're always shouting and we're always cursing at each other. And all day long, he says, that's what I'm involved in. He says, and then I get here and I'm working with these kids and all of a sudden I got to turn all that off. He says, I'm having a hard time. Can you imagine having to work in an environment where you're always shouting and you're always cursing at each other? Maybe some of you are in that. You know, you deal with that kind of thing all day long. Is that really fun? Is that enjoyable? Or do you go home and you go, man, I got to get away from this? Well, apparently, Paul sees that. I don't know if he saw it in the group or maybe he just saw it out in the workplace. And he says, that's not what's supposed to characterize you. But he says, get rid of all that. And then he says, get rid of slander. And I'm sure slander is not all that far away from the shouting and cursing. You know, it's abuse and vilifying others. You idiot, you moron, you know, and worse kind of thing. And then he says, all malice, any action or attitude that intends harm. Now, instead of all of those things, he says, put on kindness and forgiveness. Wow, what a contrast. And he mentions here one another again. Be kind to one another. Tenderhearted. Forgiving one another as God in Christ forgave you. And you can throw in, I think, within this context, the exhortation that he's mentioned up in verse 29, let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths. Okay, I'm going to put that under this particular heading here. But it's the same thing, isn't it? Consider for just a moment the power of kindness and forgiveness in your relationships. I've said this before, and I to me, it's kind of a good thing to live by. Wouldn't you rather have friends than enemies? I mean, wouldn't you rather have people that were friends with you? And the more of them you had, wouldn't it be better? And I realize you can't be close to everybody, and there's some people you'll probably never be friends with. There's just the conflict between you. But consider what relationships look like, characterized by kindness, forgiveness, tenderheartedness, and no corrupting talk, but only that which builds people up. Now, you've seen these two lists. Which of the two contrasting ways of life, again, verses 31 and 32, create an environment conducive to human flourishing and good relationships? It's pretty obvious, but if you think about it that way, wouldn't you rather be in an environment that allows all of us to just flourish as human beings? To create an environment where our talents can come out and be useful, where we can feel like people like us, you know, where we have good relationships. Perhaps I'm making it simpler than it really is, but isn't that really what Paul is telling us here? Think about things that help us all to flourish. And when you come to the end of your life and you look back at your life in the wake of everything you've done, what have you done? What does the wake of your boat look like? What have you left in your wake? When I was younger, I had an uncle who had a runabout, like a 16-foot speedboat. And he bought this particular speedboat because the wake was really very calm, and it was great for skiing. And the, you know, the boat would get up on the water, and wouldn't it, the wake was very low, and it didn't create a lot of turmoil behind it. Well, I kind of like to think of these things, kindness, forgiveness, tenderheartedness, they're not leaving a wake of destruction behind us, are they? But I will tell you, these other things will. And when you look back on your life, maybe, hopefully not when it's too late, what do you look back and you see? What have you left behind you? Think about your bucket list. And if you leave behind you a wake of destruction and turmoil, I hope you think about it before it's too late, and maybe you can change that and leave behind you something better. I think all of what he's saying here are the kinds of things that can make what you leave behind you better than if you did it the other way. And it kind of all boils down here to verses 1 and 2 of chapter 5, doesn't it? Be imitators of God. Walk in love as Christ walked in love. All of these teachings cannot be separated from our whole sense of the Christian faith, because they all go back to God. They all go back to what Christ has done for us. And you see, all these teachings, essentially, they are participations in Jesus, who is the bread of life. These things are part of the bread of life. And maybe if we think about them that way, it becomes kind of significant about what we do with the rest of our lives. You know, what kind of food are we feeding on? What kind of food are we giving others? How is it affecting other people? You know, from Jesus, all of these things come. He's the head of the body, and all of these things come from him. And you see, I believe because he is called the bread of life, all these teachings are things that lead to flourishing our human relationships. Isn't that what you really want? You know, and I know it's hard to give in to, you know, the impulses of all kinds of other things, but we all kind of want human flourishing for ourselves, for other people. You really won't have the power to do these things, by the way, until you undergo the transformation that Paul talks about in chapter 4, verses 22 to 24. Put off the old self, put on the new, because of Jesus Christ and the gospel of Jesus Christ. It kind of all boils down. That's the foundation. You do it, and you're able to do these things because you have, first of all, accepted the gospel of Jesus Christ. Everything kind of flows from that. You must first believe in him. You must die to your old self in baptism. And it's from there that you have the power to walk in newness of life. These things are newness of life. They will make your relationships flourish. Isn't it time you made these things your bucket list? Thank you.